Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Booster shots may soon become available to more people. FDA advisory panels endorsed moving forward on boosters for those who received the Johnson & Johnson and Moderna vaccines. However, booster recommendations vary. For the past month, Pfizer booster shots for those eligible have been rolling out. So here to help us understand better the latest developments is Dr. Donald J. Elsendor, Associate Professor at Meharry Medical College. He's also a former voting member on the FDA Antimicrobial Drug Advisory Committee. Dr. Elsendor, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Meharry Medical College is based in Nashville, and it's the first medical school created for African Americans in the South nearly 150 years ago. But I learned that you also have some familiarity with the Sacramento area. You attended UC Davis as an undergrad.
That is correct. I had some of my best days at UC Davis.
You're an Aggie. The last time you joined us was a little over 2 months ago in August, and you were explaining to us how the FDA approval process for vaccines, with your background with the FDA, how it actually works. Now, in that time, has the vaccine and booster process gone as expected, or have there been some surprises for you?
Well, when we think about boosters, traditional vaccines, the need for boosters are determined very early in the course of vaccine development. This is something new. And I think it's new because this epidemic has been unprecedented, forcing us to find ways to develop vaccines at a very rapid pace, more rapid than we've ever done before. And so the idea is that boosters are usually put into the equation very early in the course of vaccine development. This is very new. And so the FDA advisory board is working very hard to look at all the data that's available for their recommendations. And I want to say, whatever the FDA advisory board recommendations are, these are not binding. They have to also be approved by the FDA and, of course, get CDC guidelines by their advisory board as well.
I mean, you mentioned how unprecedented this is, but does any of this remind you of your time and your working with the FDA?
Absolutely. And again, it reminds me of how this information that comes from clinical trial is so highly scrutinized before a decision is made. And so when that decision is made, the FDA advisory board gives a recommendation. And of course, the FDA usually will follow the guidance of their advisory board, unless there is some maybe unprecedented information that they don't get at the time when the advisory board makes their recommendation.
Before we begin parsing out the differences of potential boosters for Moderna and Johnson & Johnson, can you just break down the difference between getting a second dose, which happened for both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, compared to a booster shot?
Yeah, so I want to say something about what is considered an additional dose. So that's something that's also referred to as a third dose. So the third dose or additional dose is for people who may not have a strong enough immune response from the first two doses of Moderna and Pfizer or the single dose of J&J. Now, how that differs from a booster shot is for people whose immune response may have weakened over time. And that would be like most of us. Now, the booster in particular, again, there are guidelines for who will get the booster, who will be recommended for the booster, how long after you've received the primary doses that you would be eligible for the booster as well.
FDA advisory panels last week, I mean, as you know, endorsed booster shots for both Moderna
yes.
and Johnson & Johnson, but that's, you know, it's far from, you know, over. There's still a process that needs to take
yes.
place. But with your experience, I'm just curious, can you explain what kind of conversations are taking place among committee members?
So what they're saying is that for Pfizer, this has been something that's been accomplished. But when they're saying that nearly 15 million and nearly 69 million for Johnson & Johnson and Moderna, respectively, in terms of people that have those vaccines already, there should be an option for them to get boosters, particularly for those individuals that are at high risk of acquiring severe disease or hospitalizations from COVID-19 infections.
What are the biggest differences between a Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson booster?
So it's getting very interesting in that regard. So when we think about Johnson & Johnson boosters, studies have been done that suggest that a booster for Johnson & Johnson may be better as a Pfizer or Moderna booster, because what they have seen is that there is evidence that suggests that a Pfizer or Moderna booster will produce a more robust immune response than a Johnson & Johnson booster. And so that's going to be up for debate. And of course, there are members of the advisory board that is suggesting that the Johnson & Johnson product be considered as a two-dose product as opposed to a one-dose product in the future. There will be deliberations about this in the coming weeks. And of course, it's going to be FDA decision and CDC guidelines that will follow.
Well, given that there are differences and it's getting interesting, when you're weighing as a committee member whether a booster is effective, what could be the potential harm for getting a booster, because it's differing now between the vaccines?
So it comes down to the point, who needs a booster, who doesn't need a booster, and what is the goal of giving a booster shot? So for those individuals that don't need a booster, these are going to be individuals that are relatively healthy, that have had their two doses of either Pfizer and Moderna and do not fall outside the eligibility criteria for receiving a booster, meaning suppressed immune response, working in places, healthcare workers, where they may be subject to a higher number of exposures, a job that would put you at greater risk, travel and so forth. But the idea is that with these boosters, you want to be able to protect those individuals that are more likely to experience severe disease because they have an immune system that may be dysfunctional, or they have certain types of medical issues that would put them at a greater risk. And of course, I want to make it clear that if a person had the traditional two doses of Pfizer, Moderna, or the one dose of Johnson & Johnson, this brings still a high degree of protection for those individuals against hospitalizations and ICUs and severe disease associated with COVID, even the Delta variant. And so even with your two doses, you have a level of protection that would prevent severe disease and keep you from being hospitalized due to COVID. Now, for those individuals that have a dysfunctional immune response, it may be weakened to the point where they're not able to develop a strong enough immune response from their first two doses or their single dose of Johnson & Johnson.
Well, that actually is reassuring to people who may be thinking like, hey, I got vaccinated back in the spring and they're wondering, like, I've hit or passed the 6 months of getting vaccinated, but I'm not currently eligible for a booster. So what you're saying is they shouldn't be concerned if they're not eligible because they're not immunocompromised or in an at-risk group.
That is correct. And they are still considered fully vaccinated if they got the two scheduled doses from Moderna, Pfizer, and the one dose of Johnson & Johnson.
Going back to the initial debate just surrounding whether boosters were needed, initially the Biden administration wanted boosters to be available for larger groups of people, but members of the advisory panel and medical community pushed back and they questioned the efficacy of a booster. With your expertise, what goes through your mind with that debate?
So I think what you want to do is you want to look at targeting of a booster at this point. And so to give everybody a booster, you're giving a third dose to people that are fully vaccinated when you have 66 million people that have not had their full vaccinations. And so when we look at hospitalizations and we look at deaths associated with COVID-19 at this point, it's among mostly the unvaccinated in the population. And so that has to be recognized as a priority when it comes to vaccinating people. And so there are some people that have their third dose already. Now, I want to say very clearly that the difference between the Pfizer as opposed to the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson that's been recommended is that the Johnson & Johnson and Moderna has been recommended to all folks that are eligible for the vaccine, not just those that are immune compromised. And so that's going to be very important.
Right. There are also evaluations about whether people can mix vaccines, particularly for those who receive Johnson & Johnson because it was a one dose. I mean, what conversations are taking place? And is this normal practice? Historically, have there been other vaccines where mixing doses is currently taking place?
So the idea is that having more than one vaccine as at an appointment is something that's done routinely in children and in adults. And again, the idea is that mixing these vaccines have not been a problem if it's been shown in the past that you get a robust immune response to the individual vaccine candidates. And so there is a great discussion going on right now at the advisory committee looking at Johnson & Johnson as a mixture of either Pfizer and Moderna for the second dose, because there's evidence that suggests that you get a better or robust immune response with a second dose as a Pfizer or Moderna if you had an initial single dose of the J&J vaccine. So what has been proposed by the committee is that it suggested that the FDA may suggest to Johnson & Johnson that their product in the future may be a two-dose vaccine as opposed to a single dose, just to give you that robust immune response that they're hoping for.
Another big milestone would involve expanding the vaccine to younger children. What's being weighed in regards to this group?
It's caution. And again, the numbers are in a lot of ways. I think you will start to see guidance on this before Thanksgiving. And again, remember, this is non-binding. It will be the FDA and the CDC to give guidance on this. However, I see something that is starting to happen, and that is hesitant parents are likely to have children that they will not likely want to consent for a vaccine. We're already seeing anti-vaxxers ready to protest if there is mandates regarding childhood vaccines for COVID-19. So the 5 to 11 years old group that are likely to be eligible for the vaccine very soon, we're talking about 28 million people that will now become eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine. This is very important. And of course, being able to vaccinate those children at a rapid rate would be important as well. How much will the schools participate in this? What will the federal government do to support vaccination among these young children? All of this is to be seen. Here at Meharry Medical College, we are getting ahead of the game. I'm working with some very capable people in Dr. Juarez, Dr. Paul Juarez, and Dr. Dwayne Smooth here at Meharry. We're taking vaccinations to the people, and in this case, to the young people. And so in both our general participation in the Tennessee SEAL program with Dr. Paul Juarez and our mobile vaccination units with Dr. Dwayne Smooth, we're excited about what we can do to help get children vaccinated.
Before we let you go, you know, advisory panels gave their blessing, but there are other steps. Realistically, when could people who received Moderna and Johnson & Johnson start getting their boosters?
I would say very soon, because there will be discussions about that this week. And so it could possibly be next week or the week after. So very soon. And again, I want everybody to understand that there's a time period that you have to wait before you're eligible for the booster. With Pfizer, which is the only one that's currently providing boosters, you have to wait 6 months after your second vaccination before you're eligible for a booster. That will be sooner with Johnson & Johnson and Moderna. That's likely to be 2 weeks as currently designated. But again, could be changed based on FDA and CDC guidelines.
Dr. Alcindor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is Dr. Donald Alcindor, associate professor at Meharry Medical College and a former voting member on the FDA Antimicrobial Drug Advisory Committee. Up next, now that new COVID testing and vaccine mandates have taken effect for teachers and school staff in California, we'll explore the concern that the already existing staffing shortages might get worse. Also, new research reveals the messy truth about teen girls and Instagram. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. School districts across the state are faced with a new concern that already existing staffing shortages might get worse. The state's requirement for COVID vaccines or testing officially kicked in on Friday, and anecdotally, some school staff have threatened to resign. This latest complicated chapter on education during the pandemic is an added layer of uncertainty in an evolving web of decisions and mandates affecting students and adults. Next year, the vaccine requirements will become even stricter. If you recall, the governor announced that all eligible students and staff on campus will need to be vaccinated and testing will no longer suffice. A handful of school districts are already getting a head start. Last week, Sac City Unified joined several other school districts in the state, implementing the vaccine mandate before the state's takes effect. So, here to give us a look at the big picture is Diana Lambert, a senior education reporter for EdSource. Diana cast a wide net across the state and found that the conversation and fight over vaccine mandates largely depends on where school districts are located. Diana joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Hi, Vicky. Thank you for having me on.
Diana, before we go through your recent reporting, I mean, you've been covering education for well over a decade. How has this year of reporting been for you?
Exhausting. You know, there are so many twists and turns and new things that happen every day. So it's been quite an interesting year.
Remind us about the challenges of teachers and school staff retention before the pandemic.
Oh, we've had a teaching shortage for many years, and it has increased during the pandemic as people have just quit early, retired early, or simply decided not to work anymore. So, you know, especially in the area of substitute teachers, bus drivers, and instructional aides, right now we have a severe shortage.
With that in mind, what have been the biggest surprises for you as a reporter covering this?
I think the biggest surprises have been the pushback on, I think, all the masking and vaccinations, et cetera, during this year. That has been unusual.
The state requirement for teachers and school staff vaccines or testing, it went into effect officially on Friday. In the days and weeks, however, leading up to this, what were you hearing that led you to dive deeper into it?
Well, yes, I've heard a lot from the rural school districts, small school districts, who really are fearful of having these mandates for fear their shortages will get even greater. And many of the school leadership and school boards in those areas also agree they don't believe that people should be forced to have vaccinations or to even to mask.
Yeah, given that you spoke with several school districts and associations across the state, I mean, you just mentioned rural school districts, in addition, urban, small, large. What did you learn sifting through all of that?
Well, I did learn that the issue is the greatest in the conservative areas and the areas that are rural. For example, in MODOC Joint Unified in Alturas, 31 of their teachers have said they resign instead of taking the COVID test or vaccine. And that's a great number, a good percentage of their teachers. And I spoke to a lady, Sherry Morgan, an executive director at Long Valley Charter School in Doyle in Lassen County, a very small conservative town. And she said that even in best of times, she can't staff. So with these vaccine mandates, she's afraid she may have to close her school.
Wow. I mean, that really just hits home that when it comes to rural areas, I mean, there's this added challenge of being remote and small. So even losing one or two, or you even mentioned a few dozen, is a huge dent. And there's really no guarantee of rehiring.
Exactly.
What about South Lake Tahoe? Is there anything unique or different about that district?
Well, yes. You know, they already lost quite a few people because of the Caldor fire. So they're struggling with staffing problems, shortages that existed for years. On top of that, they have people who have left the area because of the Caldor fire. And now they're having vaccine mandates and testing mandates that some employees don't like.
The conversations and debates are potentially mirroring political leanings of a community or a county. But what I found interesting in your reporting, even the largest school district, Los Angeles Unified, is also facing these challenges. Why?
It's hard to know why they're not, they are, but what it comes down to is their staff, they've had trouble getting their staff to turn in their verification that they've been vaccinated. So they had to push the date back from October 15th to November 15th to get for people to be fully vaccinated. It's unclear exactly why. Maybe people will step up with an extra month.
Here in Sacramento, as I kind of led with, Sac City Unified joined a handful of school districts across the state, issuing a vaccine mandate for eligible students and staff. And they did that before the state's deadline. Does Sacramento face unique challenges?
They do. They have independent study. Everyone has independent study, but at Sac City Unified, they're having trouble staffing their independent study. And they feel that if more students have to be vaccinated, their parents might want to put them into independent study instead, because that is the option if you don't want to be vaccinated. And they're fearful that they won't be able to staff that. Right now, teachers must volunteer for those positions, and they just don't have enough volunteers.
Yeah, I've been in Sacramento now for about 6 years, and I've covered that this district has been on the brink of insolvency for several years. How does that factor into the equation when we're talking about teacher retention?
It factors into the equation, because if students leave the district, if they decide to go to other districts where there isn't a vaccine mandate yet, or they will then have to lose teachers, because they'll lose money. Their average daily attendance funding will be reduced, and then they'll have to lay people off.
Before we let you go, and what in your recent reporting is sparking issues that you're going to continue to follow up on in the weeks to come? I mean, I know you're already exhausted hopping from one like lily pad of an issue to another, but there's clearly more work to be done.
There really is. So we'll be following, we'll be following independent study and how that is rolling out. And of course, the staffing shortages and whether there will be enough teachers for staffing. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of contention over the vaccine mandate as it rolls out in next year. So we'll be following that. So we'll just be following the whole gamut of educational issues to COVID.
Well, we look forward to having you back on, Diana.
All right. Thank you so much, Vicki.
Diana Lambert is a senior education reporter for EdSource. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Well, many of us have gone down the rabbit hole of scrolling on social media. I mean, you hop on to check your notifications, and before you know it, time just kind of slips by. As Facebook in particular comes under fire, a big focus of concern is how Instagram, which Facebook owns, shaped the mental health and self-esteem of children. Today, we're going to hone in on teenage girls. Jessica Gross is a parenting columnist at the New York Times, joining us with what the research actually says about teen girls' body image and Instagram, and really how it compares to TV and magazines. Welcome to Insight, Jessica.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Happy to have you. The Facebook whistleblower developments and stories really kind of ripped the lid off conversations that have already been taking place on social media's unhealthy influence on people of all ages. But what was particularly damning was the accusations about the upcoming Instagram Kids, which has since been put on pause. As a parenting columnist, I mean, it's fitting to dive into this, but what surprised you along the way?
What surprised me was that I read a lot of the headlines before delving into the research, and, you know, it said things like, Instagram is toxic for teen girls. It's a cesspool. So my first response was, I want to keep my daughters off social media till they're 40. But actually looking at the research, it's not as uniformly negative as those headlines might suggest, which is not to say it's good. Images that encourage girls to have thinness as an ideal have been damaging since before social media. So when we were growing up in the 80s and 90s, magazines and TV that had thinness as an ideal were not great for teen girls in and of themselves. And so they continue to not be great for teen girls when they are delivered to them on Instagram. The research suggests that it is slightly worse, but nowhere near the sort of toxic cesspool, those sorts of words that we were hearing a lot in those headlines.
Yeah, I mean, for me as a teenager, I remember like 17 Magazine or Teen Vogue, MTV, you know, music videos and things like that, that definitely affect your body image.
Yeah, I remember coveting TLC. I just thought they were the coolest. They looked the best. They had the coolest fashion. So I remember that image has stuck with me, you know, 15, 20 years later. And that's not to say that for younger teens, especially, that they should just have unfettered access to social media. I think it's good news that Facebook has backed away from doing Instagram for under 13. Kids just really should not be on social media at all at those ages, according to all the research and all the experts that we have out there. But that doesn't mean that we can't teach kids, even at that young age, to start thinking critically about the images that they see.
Right. I mean, in dealing with the reality that social media is here to stay. I mean, I have friends who take a break from social media, like they'll post it on Facebook or Instagram. They'll take like a 1 week detox. And I think that just really hits home that not only how easy it is to get swept away, but also how social media is just ingrained in our lives. And as a parent, I mean, you mentioned you would hope that your teen girls would not use Instagram, you know, until they're 40. But realistically, you know, you realize that that's not possible. So how do you help parents navigate that?
Absolutely. My kids are only 8 and 5, so I have a little bit of a ways before we get there. But they are already consuming things on TV that can help them look critically at the images that they're seeing. So in my column, I recommend an episode of the Netflix show Brainchild that deconstructs social media and shows how many takes it takes to get a perfect photo. It unpacks how addictive social media can be. So it's about having conversations with your kids when they're seeing unrealistic images and sort of getting them to think, oh, do you think that was altered in any way? Like, my kids already know about filters. They know about the silly, you know, dog and cat filters that you can get on Instagram and Snapchat. And so they already know the way that images can be manipulated. Even on FaceTime, you can do effects, something called effects, which they love to do when they're FaceTiming with their grandparents. So they are already inculcated into these ideas, and you just have to keep having the conversations with them and drawing them out. Another thing that you can do with your kids, but also for yourself, is making sure that your feeds are curated. So if you're following someone, let's say on Instagram, and they consistently make you feel bad about yourself, stop following them. Like, it sounds simplistic, but I personally know the draw of having those sort of bad, good feelings and sort of almost picking at that scab. So just being really intentional about who you're following. And when your kids do get on social media, like, you know, 15, 16, if that's part of their lives, you know, talking to them about that, saying like, are these images making you feel good or are they making you feel bad? And just having them really think a lot about who they're following and why, what that's doing for them. Because what the research also shows is that if you follow body positive accounts or you follow humorous accounts, they can actually make you feel better. They can improve your mood. So just only framing social media as bad, social media is a huge place. There are a million Instagrams. And so making sure if your kids are going to be on Instagram, that it's the good Instagram and not the bad Instagram is really the takeaway.
Yes. There was you interviewed a doctor who basically said, like, just being on Instagram isn't harmful. It's how you use the platform. Does that conversation change when talking about other platforms like Snapchat or TikTok, which are also popular among kids?
I think it's all pretty much the same. We can't control the algorithms that exist on those platforms. You know, as parents, we can only talk to our kids about how they are using those tools and set limits on how many hours a day that they are using them. So that's the other thing you can do as a parent, really set limits and model good behavior. I mean, I fall into a TikTok hole the same way teenagers do. It is highly entertaining and really fun. And so having behaviors like never having phones at the dinner table, leaving phones in one place, the adults and the teenagers, after a certain hour of the day, like just having boundaries around the use of, you know, of these tools, they are always going to be part of our lives, these smartphones. And so kind of developing good habits as a teenager will serve you once you're out of the house.
How do likes and followers factor in? Because I know, you know, people care about that, how many followers you have or how many likes a post gets.
So what some of the research shows is that you should really kind of discourage your kids from posting too many selfies, because that sort of sets off that feedback loop of behavior. So, you know, really feeling like people are judging you and your face and your body is really set off by when you are the one posting the images and seeing the positive or negative comments that come back. And so if social media, this image forward type of social media, is more negative than TV and magazines, which it seems to be slightly, but not extremely more negative, it is because of that feedback loop. It is because you are seeing your friends and your peers post in real time comments, not only maybe on your face or body, but on your other peers' faces and bodies. And that's a lot to take in when you're a teenager. I mean, you see it at school, obviously. Again, we were all teens in the pre-social media era. People said nasty things then. It existed. But I think there's something about hearing it in the sanctity of your home or not really being able to get away from it that I think can be more painful. So again, it's just about having those good boundaries, teaching your kid those good boundaries, because you, again, as much as I would want my kids to not look at it till they're 40, that's not realistic.
Well, not to mention, I mean, children are in their third school year living with a pandemic, which some degree of physical disconnect or even just a heavier reliance on digital. I mean, that's been hard on all of us. I mean, we are Zooming right now. I mean, how does this factor in for teenagers?
So I think that parents have rightly allowed a lot more leeway in terms of the amount of use of social media, because their kids need their friends. They need to talk to their friends. And, you know, I think in the worst parts of the pandemic, you know, spring and summer 2020, the only way to connect and have relationships with friends was over, you know, social media of some sort. And so, you know, I can give myself as an example. I let my older daughter, who is almost 9, onto Roblox much earlier than I would have, because there was a social aspect to it. Her friends were on it. They would play like these little games. And while, you know, I was monitoring it and making sure she was only talking to people that she knew, it was really a positive thing in her life. She had fun with it. She could connect with them there. And we can't overlook the fact that that is a valid way of socializing and a real way of socializing. And I can tell you, again, anecdote but not data, my daughter literally said to me last night, you know, now that I see my friends every day at school, like, I'm not interested in Roblox. So, you know, I think that it was for a while a replacement for that in-person socialization. And as long as it's additive and not replacing all of their in-person socialization, now that I think things are opened back up, like, you know, it's just part of life now in a way that I think we can think of it as a separate thing, but it, especially for our kids who have this technology in a more native way, it's just part of life. It's not a separate thing.
We're talking broadly about teenage girls, but is there any research getting more specific when it comes to children of color or within the LGBTQ plus community? I mean, does the influence of social media change in any way?
So I have seen good research actually that shows that for LGBTQ plus, it can be more positive because they see more representations of themselves and a broader sort of diversity, especially when it comes to gender presentation, exists on social media than they may see being affirmed in real life. I haven't really delved into the evidence sort of racially and socioeconomically, but my sense is sort of across the board, it is more about time spent on social media and the types of activities done on social media than necessarily sort of social media as a bad thing.
Got it.
As in and of itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it certainly does. Well, with everything we've all taken in from you, we know the pop culture and body image issues have been around long before even dial-up existed. And girls in particular have been shaped and harmed with these unrealistic expectations that really shapes us as adults today. So when it comes to Instagram, is the criticism that Instagram that they're receiving, is it fair or is it just more of the same?
I think it's fair. I mean, I think it was fair to criticize teen magazines and MTV for perpetuating these images 20, 30 years ago. I think they, at least my reading of the data and the internal dialogue, shows that they knew it was a problem and they did nothing about it. And I think that in and of itself deserves criticism, whether or not, you know, it should, how it should be regulated, if it should be regulated, that is a much bigger conversation that is sort of outside my wheelhouse as a parenting columnist, though I do have my own personal feelings about it. I think that the criticism is absolutely fair and warranted. And I think seeing parents push back, even having these conversations with your much older, if your kids are in high school, you know, they might be aware of this news. And so talking to them about it and sort of unpacking it with them and, you know, criticizing these unfair beauty standards is a great conversation to have with teenage boys or teenage girls. I mean, there is some evidence that unfair standards of, you know, muscles and expectations on male body image, that's not great for boys either. You know, it's less impactful, the research shows, than on girls. But that doesn't mean that boys are, you know, it free for all permanently on social media. They can spend as many hours as they want and it's not damaging. Like, that's not true either. And I mean, I think, you know, just as a citizen, I would have to say I'm more alarmed by the sort of privacy issues and the data issues and the threats to democracy than I necessarily am on what's going on with teens. So, you know, a lot to unpack there with what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And even what you're saying, I mean, we're talking about teenagers and children, but a lot of this can also apply to adults. Like, I'm thinking of some people I know that could actually benefit from this segment. Jessica, thank you so much for just sharing your work with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jessica Gross is a parenting columnist at the New York Times, explaining what the research says about teen girls' body image and Instagram and how it compares to TV and magazines. Still ahead, the Sacramento Philharmonic and Opera welcomes a new leader. We'll be joined by both the outgoing executive director and the incoming about the change in command and how this will shape what's in store for the future. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. During the pandemic, the Sacramento Philharmonic and Opera shifted to continue providing music to people in a virtual way, meeting people where they are, as they say. You know, the shift provided members a chance to continue to enjoy music while keeping to social distancing and stay-at-home protocols. But this isn't the first time the Sacramento Philharmonic worked hard to try to keep music in the lives of locals. Back in 2015, the Sacramento Philharmonic and Opera had a canceled season and a new interim executive director with a plan to get live performances going again. Over the course of what will be a seven-year tenure, Alice Sauro heightened fundraising efforts and was able to boost attendance at the Sac Phil and Opera's performances. But starting in February, the Sacramento Philharmonic and Opera will welcome a new executive director, and Alice Sauro will continue to work with the organization as a senior advisor. At just 28, Giuliano Kornberg will be the youngest executive director for the Sackville Opera in recent memory. Giuliano and Alice join us now to reflect and really look at what's to come after this transition. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Vicky, so much for having us. We really appreciate and always appreciate the chance to chit-chat a little bit about what's going on with the Philharmonic and Opera.
Yeah, we're excited for it. You know, Alice, starting with you, you've been the executive director for almost 7 years now. What have you learned since taking over that you can pass on to Giuliano?
Well, I don't think we have enough time for that today.
Right.
It's certainly been a wonderful experience, a lot of change, getting to know this community, coming from the Midwest to a community that has a lot of Midwest people. So I felt very at home, and people embraced me. And this community really, what we noticed was they really missed their music during the 2014-15 dark period, and were elated to have us back. And so it was wonderful to get the concerts going again, bring people together. We are now drawing on those experiences, Vicky, today, as we again come back from a dark period. And everything is a little bit in the wrong order, but we're all driving to the concerts. And we just had a concert in September with 1,100 people.
That must have felt pretty good.
Yes.
When you look back at that time when there was really just a lot of uncertainty surrounding the future of the organization back in 2014, 2015, and you stepped in, how do you reflect on that time?
We did a lot of listening. We had to see what were people interested in. We did start our pop-up series where we, again, for the first time, I should say, we brought the music to the people. So we went right on street level. We were playing string quartets and brass groups, and the kids could come up and talk to the musicians and ask them about their instrument. And we met families at the farmers market. It was really organic, and the community loved it. And then they say, hey, let me see your brochure. I'd like to come and see you. I didn't know we had a symphony or an opera company here.
Why in Sacramento have symphony orchestras had kind of a difficult history in the city?
I think for many years they had a wonderful history. So there was just a period of time where there was a lot of transitioning, you know, and some of the tastes of some of the younger folks changed, and not as many people were coming to classical music. But I think we're getting a shift back to that. People really appreciate what classical music is and what it provides, and how all of these rock bands and indie rock bands, like what you say that you like to listen to, all of that really comes from the compositions and the instruments from the classical genre.
Yeah. Well, Giuliano, you joined the team 5 years ago. What brought you to the Sacramento Philharmonic and Opera?
In a word, Alice. So at the time I was 23, I had just graduated from school, and I, you know, in undergrad and grad school, And I really realized that for me, trying to find a job and build a career in the performing arts nonprofit administration, specifically in orchestras, seemed like the right move. So at the time, it was summertime of 2016. I was looking for a job. I just sent a whole bunch of feeler emails out to prospective potential employers. Just, I'm Giuliano. I just finished school. I'm currently at San Francisco Opera. I think I'd be a good fit for your organization because of X, Y, and Z. Maybe we should talk. And one of the hits, one of the few hits, in fact, was Alice. So we traded emails, spoke on the phone, met in person at a conference. I came up in August of that summer to meet the team. And she decided to give a 23-year-old kid with not a lot of experience a shot to try to raise funds for the Philharmonic and Opera. And I will certainly always be grateful for that experience and kind of what happened. Alice's work in the last 6.5 years, of course, leading the organization, but really being willing to foster an environment for younger people like me to learn and grow and develop and take risks and like make mistakes and maybe learn from those mistakes. That has been so tremendously impactful for me. And I would argue the entire staff of the Philharmonic and Opera. And I would certainly not be here in this current position without her and her guidance and her mentorship. So I will always be appreciative of that.
5 years ago, did you envision becoming the new executive director?
Oh, gosh. You know, we had so much work to do, I think, 5 years ago, just getting out there, like Alice said, listening to donors, listening to the community, really trying to cultivate support so that our vision of putting, you know, as many high quality shows as possible, you know, here for this community. That was the focus at the time. And I think that really has continued to be this focus. How can we serve the community of Sacramento through our work and programming? And how can we have conversations and build support and work collaboratively, Alice and I, the staff, with the board, with the musicians, to give back to this community? Because that's why we exist, to perform great music and serve and give back to this wonderfully supportive community of Sacramento. So that was the focus. And I think that will continue to be the focus going forward.
Well, narrowing in on that, what changes were made that should continue beyond the pandemic now that you'll be the incoming executive director come, you know, 2022?
Yeah. You know, after this, you know, past year and a half period that was so hard for everybody, I think we're just excited to get back to live performance. Like Alice said, we had our first show in Memorial Auditorium on September 10th. We had a 4th of July performance earlier this year at Sutter Health Park in partnership with the Rivercats. And that was a lot of fun because about 4,500 people were there, many of whom were first-time attendees and young families. That was a great community event. This Saturday, we're performing with Andrea Bocelli, the really big-time superstar tenor at the Golden One Center. And of course, we return to the newly renovated Safe Credit Union Performing Arts Center in November. So, and at that point, we get into the flow of the season. So just being able to perform live from the stage, Alice mentioned pop-up concerts, you know, all of that is really integral to the DNA of the Sacramento Philharmonic and Opera. Continuing to do that, continuing to listen, continuing to grow responsibly and be proper stewards of everyone's wonderful support, that I think is how we will continue to be successful for the community of Sacramento. And that to me is just incredibly exciting.
I love hearing about all that momentum picking up. You and Alice, you're not really going anywhere. You're still going to be part of the Sackville and Opera family. What will you be doing under your new role?
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't want to leave this community. There's still so much work to be done. Now that we have really built this solid foundation, Giuliano can take over the work of the day-to-day and getting everything going in that way. I'll stay on to, you know, still answer questions and be a mentor or whatever the staff will need, including Giuliano. But more importantly, one of the things that I took on early on, because we didn't have one, was the music director role. And so for those of you that have come to our concerts, we have a different conductor every time. And so I've been working on programming with our marketing advisor over these last 7 years. And I will continue to do that while we explore what new conductors we want to bring in, what new music we might want to bring in, and keep the artistic integrity and quality of this organization high as we have been over the last 7 years. And so I look very much forward to that.
When looking for a new executive director, what stood out to you about Giuliano?
Giuliano has the pulse on this community. He knows everybody. He's been here for 5 years. And so that's really important. When you add that knowledge to the fact that he's been in our organization internally for 5 years, he understands this unique blend that we have of symphonic and operatic presentations. And that is also an unusual model. And so for us, we've been able to make that work. And it was really terrific to see Giuliano rise to the top with his knowledge of all of those things.
I mean, Giuliano, you already were talking about, you know, you even have a busy week this week. But I guess ending on a positive note, what are you most excited about for the future in the last, you know, 30 seconds or so that we have?
Yeah, well, I love Sacramento. You know, Alice and I joke, we grew up about 5 miles apart from each other, give or take about 30 years or so in Minnesota, both kind of a couple suburb areas of Minneapolis. And just being here in Sacramento and having kind of a real Midwest vibe early on, I fell in love with Sacramento and I've continued to stay in love with Sacramento, especially the more that I've gotten tapped into what's happening. So for me, figuring out what's the most impactful for this community, performing from the stage in the community, in schools, all that work, I love Sacramento. I love personally benefiting Sacramento through our performance of live music. And that to me is really important. And that's what we're going to do going forward.
Alice and Giuliano, thank you so much for joining us and excited about this new chapter.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
And that is Alice Soro, the outgoing executive director for the Sacramento Philharmonic and Opera, and Giuliano Kornberg, and who will become the incoming executive director for the Sackville Opera this coming February. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Pauline Bartoloni, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.